Good evening and welcome to The Kelly File, everyone. I'm Megyn Kelly. Janice Dean will join us live this hour on the big news about this major storm threatening 4th of July plans for millions. First, though, the final part of our exclusive interview with the domestic terrorist turned college professor who helped launch the political career of our current president. In 2008, Professor Bill Ayers was introduced to America as the founder of the violent radical group, the Weather Underground. That introduction came when it was discovered that Ayers, a man who hid from the FBI for a decade, helped launch the political career of a young Chicago politician by the name of Barack Obama, a man who was seeking the Oval Office. So how exactly did that happen? And what are we to make of that? We'll get to that. But first, you need to know how Ayers came to talk with us. That happened when he agreed to join filmmaker Dinesh D'Souza right here on this set for a special we will air in full this 4th of July at 9 p.m. Eastern in a debate about America. Watch. Let's start with that, whether America is a force for good. Dinesh says in the movie, Professor Ayers, that one side, his side, believes America is exceptionally good, and the other believes it's exceptionally bad.
What other? The other side?
Is that you? Is that Bill's side?
Your side.
I don't believe there's two sides, but I have a very different view. I think that America plays a role that's both good and bad in the world, that there's a tradition in America that I strongly support, and it's the tradition of dissidents. It's the tradition of radicals. It's the tradition of revolutionaries. So you can see from the beginning, the first Bill of Rights was the push from below. The abolitionist movement was the push from below, the women's movement, suffrage. These are things that I think are great in the American tradition, and they show us something important, which is that people can affect the outcome of national policy. They can become a force for good, and that to me is one of the great things about America.
No matter the means necessary?
Well, it depends. No, of course the means matter. But so you're getting digging into
wherever
that.
Could I be going?
Where could you be going? No, of course the means matter. But the point is that if you look back in history and you say, who are the people who we remember for all the great things they did? Even if you take, say, Lyndon Johnson, Abraham Lincoln, Lyndon Johnson was never part of the Black Freedom Movement. He responded to a Black Freedom Movement on the ground. And same with Abraham Lincoln. He never belonged to an abolitionist party. He was responding to force from below. So do I think Harriet Tubman did good things? I do. Was she carrying a pistol in her pocket? She was. Did John Brown do the right thing by hurling his entire life and his family against slavery? He did. And those are the people I look to.
It's interesting that you chose to name two presidents to start off with who are, you know, our commanders-in-chief who sign laws, bills into law and abide by, not in all circumstances, but are expected to abide by the rule of law, something that you have often flouted in your own history.
No, but both of those presidents were actually responding to movements that didn't always abide by the rule of law. I mean, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Freedom Movement, broke the law consistently. And that was part of the strength and beauty of it. And the Black Freedom Movement grew and evolved every minute, every day. The kind of story we tell about it today is mostly a myth and mostly not true. But the push for justice, the push for equality, the push for participation was something that was magnificent. And that was coming from below, and much of it was against the law.
What about
Lincoln? Lincoln was responding to revolution.
Well, we happen to be in a revolutionary nation. Where America began with the revolution, and I would call it the spirit of 1776 was a revolutionary spirit. So the American founders, far from being status quo guys, broke the law themselves, the law of the British Crown, and established a revolutionary country based upon principles of equality, based upon principles of Christianity, and principles of commerce. Now, if you look at the reform movements in America, John Brown, for example, was powerfully motivated by Christianity. The abolitionist movement is impossible if it wasn't for Christianity. Martin Luther King says, I'm submitting a promissory note. Well, who wrote a promissory note? Not the Southern segregationists. It was Thomas Jefferson. So a Virginia slaveholder wrote the charter that Martin Luther King relied on 200 years later to have a civil rights movement in the first place. So the point is that you couldn't have radicalism. The radicalism itself is parasitic upon the principles of 1776.
What do you make, as you say that the terrorists who bombed the Pentagon in our past thought that they were doing good because America was bad, and you turn out to be referring not to the 9/11 Al-Qaeda terrorists, but to Mr. Ayers, Professor Ayers' group, the Weather Underground. And this goes back to the means, you know, that you get in your head that America is bad and it needs to be changed, and you pursue any means necessary to evoke that change. Dinesh equates you to actual terrorists who bombed us on 9/11.
Even in Dinesh's response to you, he pointed out that the American Revolution was violent and it was illegal. So you're not always against illegal violence. You're only against it when you think it's against the things you believe in. But the reality is we were never terrorists. And Dinesh does call our group terrorists, and it's not true. Because terrorism, even if you take Webster's definition, it's force and coercion intended to spread fear and panic to make your point. And it often involves killing civilians. We never killed anyone. We did noisy, loud, very open destruction of property at a time when 6,000 people a week were being murdered by our government. 6,000 a week.
That's what you were objecting to. I mean, we'll get to that. We'll get to the Weather Underground in a segment. So I just want the viewers to know we're going to talk about that in a separate segment. But that's what Professor Ayers believes, that as many other radicals in our country's history, he believed that the ends did justify the means, and that if you want to change the things about America to which you object and you try through peaceful means and you do not get anywhere, then what recourse do you have but to push the envelope and in some circumstances break the law?
Well, first of all, there was a big difference between, let's say, Martin Luther King breaking the law and Bill Ayers breaking the law, because Martin Luther King broke the law nonviolently. Martin Luther King's point was, if I break the law, I should accept the penalty for breaking the law. I shouldn't go hiding from the law. I should go to prison because the law is unjust. So I'm going to call the law into question morally and try to sway the American people, because I believe in the goodness of the American people. If you look at the rhetoric, Bill Ayers represents, I would call it, the spirit of 1968. And this was the radical spirit that saw America as a force for evil, saw Vietnam as a metaphor for how bad America was, and then went right back into American history and reinterpreted American history as a series of crimes visited upon different, the Native Americans, the African Americans, the Mexicans. So this became a kind of anti-Americanism that was fostered in America, and it became pervasive in our schools, our colleges. It's now part of the media.
Do you admit
that? So our culture has been shaped by this.
You don't admit that?
No, I think it's interesting. First of all, both of you are acting like the ends justify the means is absolutely from Mars, but when your ends are in question, like invading Iraq, you're all for it. You're all in, and that's the ends justify. That's a violent end. But on this question of the spirit of 68, we went back and reinterpreted history, and you act as if the reinterpretive history, reinterpretation of history was some kind of fiction. We did commit genocide against the Native Americans.
Actually,
we did enslave people for 250 years. And the question, could you be a moral person and own slaves, I think is something that you dodge. And so what I would say is, look, what I would say is, you need to look at the thing honestly and don't be so afraid of the fact that we did terrible, terrible things in our history. And in order to get right with the world, we have to repair those injuries.
But we shouldn't flagellate ourselves for things that we didn't do. Let's look at genocide. The American Indian population shrunk by 80% over 150 years. The main reason for that was not because of warfare or systematic killing. It's because the white man brought with him from Europe diseases to which the Native Americans, did not have any immunities. Yeah. And so they perished in large numbers. Now, the Europeans, one-third of the population of Europe 100 years later had been wiped out by the Black Plague. Where did that come from? Asia. So with the migration of peoples, diseases go from civilization to civilization. That's not genocide. Genocide is when you intend to wipe out a people.
They intended to wipe out the people and steal their land, and they did both.
Do you think there's a reflexive instinct on many on the left, or to the left of the left, as I guess you are, to blame America first? I mean, I thought it was interesting in one of your books, the question was, who do you think are great Americans? You know, what do you think is so great about America? And you named Edward Snowden and now Chelsea Manning, both two people who people, you know, think are traitors.
Well, some people think they're traitors. I named Jeremy Hammond as well, another whistleblower. And what amused me, Jeremy Hammond's a Chicagoan, so was Daniel Ellsberg. But when the judge sentenced Jeremy Hammond to 10 years in federal prison, she said, "You're no Daniel Ellsberg." And I wanted to scream at the television, yeah, and Daniel Ellsberg wasn't Daniel Ellsberg before he was Daniel Ellsberg. In other words, he was also called treasonous. And it's only later that we catch up with the reality. Shouldn't we have a transparent government? Shouldn't we know what our government's doing? Should we allow them to just close the door and act with impunity? That's what we're doing. Snowden stopped that.
Just about a week ago, the Pew Research Center released a study showing that only 40% of those who identify as, quote, solid liberals describe themselves as proud to be American, compared to the roughly 70% of those who describe themselves as conservatives. Why do you think it is so few liberals say they're proud to be American?
I have no idea.
Are you?
I'm not a liberal, if that's what you mean.
Are you proud to be American?
I'm not proud to be an American, and I don't buy the American exceptionalism at all. And the reason I'm not proud to be an American is because of the damage that we do around the world is so serious and so ongoing. So if you look anywhere in the world, look at all through Latin America, ordinary people on the street admire Cuba for one reason. They stood up to America. They stood up to, you know, kind of imperial advances.
We stood up to some people too. Germany.
I understand. And that was us at our best. And after 9/11,
so
the
why do you go right to the bad?
Sympathy.
Why don't you think about the good when you think about what America is?
No, I do often think about the good, but I wouldn't call myself an American exceptionalist, and I would challenge that in anybody because I'm a human being. I believe we should be struggling with the question: what does it mean to be human in the 21st century? What is it that's required of us? We are all human. We're 5%. America is 5% of the world's population. We should be part one. We should think of ourselves as a people among people, not as an exceptional people. Because as soon as you start saying American exceptionalism, then you say actions that are done by us versus other people are different depending on who does them.
This is not an unusual attitude among
exceptionalism doesn't mean a different moral standard applies. By and large, foreigners who come to America, going all the way back to Tocqueville, I've grown up in a different culture. I know America's exceptional because I see things in America that you wouldn't see anywhere else in the world. Right now, if you took the power that America has as the world's sole superpower and you gave it to Russia or you gave it to China, they would use it far more expansively, more brutally, and more to gain themselves. America is benign in the way it exercises its power. The American idea of wealth creation is being embraced in India, in China, all over the world. It's lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. So ironically, this American formula that we are moving away from at home under Obama is being enthusiastically embraced all around the world.
We're benign in Iraq, for example. You say we use our power benevolently in Iraq, Afghanistan.
Okay.
Those are benign uses
of
American
power. We went into Afghanistan because the Taliban supplied monkey bars to the guys from 9/11 who attacked us directly.
Why didn't we go and get the guys who attacked us directly instead of overthrow a government?
I'll tell you why. Because the moment we got
kicked out, which is incidentally the entire history of the last 50 years of American foreign policy, is we go in under the guise of being beneficent and benign, and we go in under the lies of one president after another, and then we get booted out. And what do? We blame the brown guy. So it's al-Maliki. And I hope al-Maliki's read his history of Vietnam and sees what happened to Diem.
Bill, do you think we're blaming al-Maliki for the mess in Iraq because he's brown?
Oh, there's no question that the United States...
Is that what you think?
I think that we always blame our clients. That's what I'm saying. So the United
States... That's a generalization. Do you think we're blaming al-Maliki for the mess in Iraq because he's brown?
I think we blame our clients, and our clients happen to be brown. So Diem, I hope al-Maliki's read about Vietnam. Diem got a bullet in the head from Kennedy, and that was because he had failed in Vietnam. We hadn't failed. We were perfect. And the same is true in Iraq.
America has made mistakes. It made mistakes in Vietnam.
Kidding.
I think the Iraq war, in retrospect,
dead.
Hold on a minute. In retrospect, the Iraq war was a mistake. But there's a difference between making a mistake and doing something that is inherently wicked. Let me tell you what I mean by this. Anyone else who went into Iraq and did this would have reimbursed itself by taking the Iraqi oil, right? Instead, we've spent all this money in Iraq, and then we turn over the keys of the oil fields to the Iraqis. We say, it's your oil. Use it, sell it, burn it. So Iraq ends up costing us money. Imperialists normally go abroad to make money.
No. You're absolutely mistaken. So you're saying that the oil is just there, and Iraq is just using it the way they see fit. And Shell has nothing to do with it, and Mobil has nothing to do with it. Standard has nothing nothing to do. You're dreaming.
On the balance, has America made money or lost money in Iraq?
On balance, the people
Thank
like
you.
Halliburton made gazillions of money. And
that's not responsive.
And your friend,
America.
Oh, absolutely. America, on balance, lost. And that's...
Okay, let me ask you this. At the end of the Cold War, all of Eastern Europe is free. Russia now no longer has a communist government. Are all those countries better off or worse off because we won the Cold War?
I don't think we won the Cold War.
Well,
I think you're dreaming about that. I think that, that
was it a good thing?
Well, I think the end of authoritarian governments is always a good thing. But I also think that this notion that somehow we go out in our beneficence, spend $1 trillion a year on military budgets, have 150 military bases circling the globe, those are not for beneficent purposes. Those are for imperial purposes.
I got to leave it at that. So Bill Ayers came to us to talk about America, but he knew we would ask about the reign of terror that grew out of what started as his group's plan to protest the Vietnam War, racism, and what they called American imperialism. If you missed that part of our interview, which we aired earlier this week, here are some of the most critical parts, which we will debate in a minute. How many bombings are you responsible for?
The Weather Underground, I think, took credit for just slightly over 20 in a period when there were 20,000 bombings in the United States against the war.
And how about you personally?
Me personally, I've never talked about it, never will.
You and your group were calling for more violence. What we saw in February of 1970, February 16th, was San Francisco police officer Brian McDonald, a 44-year-old father of two and husband, was killed when a bomb went off at his police station and eight other police officers were injured in that blast. Now, your wife, Bernadine Dorn, has been accused of that crime. Do you deny it?
Absolutely deny it. Absolutely nothing to do with it.
Bernadine Dorn was not a fan of the police and referred to them typically as pigs.
Well, that was, again, the inflated rhetoric of the time.
5 days after that San Francisco bombing that took the life of Officer Brian McDonald, the Weather Underground bombed John Murtaugh's home. John Murtaugh was...
That's also not true.
It's not true?
No, it's not true.
In your book with Bernadine, you quote the Weather Underground communique, and you say as follows, and I'm quoting now, 2 weeks before the townhouse explosion, which is a different bomb, four members of this group had firebombed Judge Murtaugh's house in New York as an action to support the Panther 21, whose trial was just beginning.
I didn't write that.
It's in your book.
Which book?
It's your book with Bernadine. It's on the board right there. Who will put it?
Race course.
It's from one of your communiques. You guys got to the point where you considered murder, and you acknowledged that yourself. It got to the point where... The property damage wasn't good enough for you, and you decided on mass murder, planning to bomb a military dance. So you understand, Professor, is that what began for your group as outrage over mass killings then turned into a plan to kill hundreds of Americans? Did you not cede the moral high ground?
Oh, absolutely, but for that was true for a few people, and it's one of the things we split on.
The only reason it didn't happen is because the bomb blew up on those who were making it. Do you appreciate the recklessness of that?
I don't say it wasn't reckless.
Who are you to potentially endanger the lives of those individuals who may have been in or around those buildings?
I don't say it wasn't reckless, and I don't say it wasn't illegal. It was illegal. We crossed lines of
legality. It's so much bigger than that, Professor Ayers. You went underground.
Yeah.
While underground, you stole. You lied. You hid, right? Any disagreement?
That's right.
You stole.
Onward, yes.
Yeah, you did. You wrote about it in your book. This is when you've resurfaced from being underground. And within a year of that, October 20th, 1981, was a triple homicide. David Gilbert of the Weather Underground, Kathy Boudin, Weather Underground, and Judy Clark, Weather Underground, partnered with the Black Liberation Army. They killed two cops, Edward O'Grady and Waverly Brown, along with a security guard named Peter Page. You were very close with Gilbert and Boudin.
Still am.
I know it. And your wife, Bernadine Dorn, was asked to cooperate in that investigation in 1982.
That's right.
She refused.
Absolutely.
She spent 7 months in jail because refused to help the police in their investigation.
Well, she refused to speak to a grand jury. That's quite different.
Nine children lost their fathers that day.
I agree
Why
with you.
Why didn't your wife help?
I agree with you. I think it was a terrible, terrible crime.
The question is whether your wife, Bernadine Dorn, felt as she did in 1970 when she seemed perfectly fine with murder. She said about the Charles Manson murders of a pregnant woman and six others, quote, offing those rich pigs with their own forks and knives and then eating a meal in the same room, far out. The weathermen dig Charles Manson. This is your sweetheart?
No,
soulmate?
This is nonsense. And this is something, again, that gets recirculated.
Do you deny she said
again,
it?
Absolutely.
You say in your book that you can't quite imagine putting a bomb in a building today, but you can't imagine entirely dismissing that possibility either. What would it take to make you bomb this country again?
Well, but you're taking that sentence in a funny way. But what I'm saying is, it seems so long ago. What I'm saying in that passage is, it seems so long ago and so far away, like another world. On the other hand, as violent and nuts as we can be as a country, I can't completely say no. I would never ever rise up in opposition in a very militant and serious way. I can't say I wouldn't. I doubt it. I'm 70 years old.
Bill Ayers, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Megan.
So given that the Weather Underground targeted the Pentagon, the Capitol, the State Department, the police, and so on, how did its founder come to help launch the career of Barack Obama? And what exactly does that tell us? We will examine that next. And later, how did people accused of bombings, robbery, and even murder come to hold prestigious jobs? One of them served 20 years in jail for murder at some of America's top universities. And for that matter, how did some of them get out of jail? Wait until you see how Attorney General Eric Holder figures into this story ahead.
Why President Obama, let me ask you this. Yeah. How much ideology did the two of you share?
Zero.
Good friends, not good friends?
I knew him as well as he knew 10,000 other people. And today I wish I knew him much better, and I wish he'd listen to me.
Did he ever contact you once you became the story in his presidential race?
Absolutely not.
You haven't
spoken to him? And I didn't contact him.
The entire time he's been president, you
never
haven't been in contact with him?
No, although I wish I were, because I have a lot of advice for him.
That was Professor Bill Ayers responding to questions about his relationship with President Obama. It was Ayers and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, also a domestic terrorist, who hosted an event at their Chicago home in 1995, where a young Barack Obama was first introduced as a candidate for the Illinois State Senate. While Ayers said his relationship with the president was casual, and Mr. Obama has since condemned the violence of the Weather Underground, what does it tell us that our now president was friendly with a man who bombed this country repeatedly? Mark Thiessen is the former chief speechwriter to President George W. Bush and an American Enterprise Institute fellow. And Kirsten Powers is a Fox News political analyst, USA Today columnist, and served in the Clinton administration. I say that not to be provocative, but to genuinely search for an answer to what it does tell us. Because I think if one thing came out of my interview with Professor Ayers, it's a full examination of what he really did. Not what he says he did when he's in public panels, but what he really did. And it puts in perspective why people were raising questions about Barack Obama's relationship with him when he was running for president, Mark.
Absolutely it does. And look, your interviews have shown without a shadow of a doubt that Bill Ayers is a noxious human being. So is his wife. He's a domestic terrorist. She's supported the Manson killings. I mean, these are noxious, detestable people. Now, it's not fair to suggest, as some have, that Barack Obama shares all of his views or that they're simpatico politically necessarily. But Barack Obama comes from the same left-wing, far-left community in Chicago that celebrates and welcomes Bill Ayers rather than shuns him as someone who is detestable. There's no evidence that until 2008, when it became an issue in his campaign, that Barack Obama had any trouble being associated with Bill Ayers. His political career, as you point out, started in his living room. Hillary Clinton pointed out they served on the same board of the same left-wing charity.
Serving on a board is one thing, but socializing, and if you read Ayers' prior writings, he talks about how they did socialize quite a bit, and they had connections with the lab school and so on. But what does it tell us, Kirsten? Because, you know, a lot of people look at Bill Ayers and they say, I would not be caught dead in that man's living room. I would not associate with him. I would not want anything to do with him, given what he has done.
Well, I guess unless you consider what he says, which is that he over and over denied what you were saying.
Oh, no, but he admitted to bombing the Capitol, bombing the Pentagon, bombing police stations, calling for the overthrow of the U.S. government, calling policemen pigs. Well, I mean, he married a woman who directly was accused of murder and repeatedly called for war against the United States. That's all admitted to.
Well, but the question is does Barack Obama know all that? And I think that's not clear to me. I think that he may have, first of all, let's just go back to the fact that he had a very vague relationship with this person. I really think it's overstated when it's said that he launched his career. Holding a fundraiser is not launching anybody's career. It's just a fundraiser.
Okay, so put that to the side.
It's being
just the friendship, or even take a step back.
But
the friendliness.
But David Axelrod said.
The friendliness. Let's take it from there. If you're Barack Obama, if you're Kirsten Powers, do you want anything to do with Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, who was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list?
Well, no, would I speak to them? I would speak to them as you're getting into politics and hold an event in their living room. I'm not quite where Mark is, where I feel I can sit around condemning people as detestable people. I mean, they did some bad things.
Well, Barack Obama said that.
Obnoxious and detestable. I mean, I thought it was a very interesting interview that you had, Megan. And I think that he has some views that are clearly not the views that Barack Obama has. To try to compare him to Barack Obama and say that, as Mark's saying, this is the world that Barack Obama came out of, he's some left-winger. Barack Obama is assassinating people. I mean, he is not anything like Bill Ayers. He is the farthest away from that. That's why Bill Ayers says, I want to get in touch with him
so I can tell him to stop doing this.
Barack Obama is the one who said that Bill Ayers was detestable. The problem is he only said it in 2008 when it became an issue in his campaign. Before that, he associated himself. David Axelrod said they were friendly. Those people are not friendly with people they consider to be detestable. And look, in the 1960s, Bill Buckley and the editors of National Review excommunicated the John Birch Society from the conservative movement. If you wanted to be taken seriously as a conservative, you didn't associate with them. The left has never excommunicated the Weather Underground or people like Bill Ayers. He's considered not somebody to be shunned, but somebody to be
ridiculous. And I have to leave it at that because any people on the left if you think that that's true.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Barack Obama.
You may be ahead of your skis on that one, KP, because our next segment is about how the left then went on to welcome Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn, and so many other members of the Weather Underground into the academic circles of this country. And I don't mean just any circles. I'm talking Bernadine Dorn, who wanted to overthrow the government, repeatedly said that, and who was on the FBI's most wanted list, 10 most wanted, is now teaching at Northwestern Law School. That's next. Well, the FBI file on the Weather Underground is deep and extensive. Not only did Ayers and his wife hide from the feds for a decade, but at one point she wound up on the 10 most wanted list. So with bombings, armed robberies, and even murder on the resumes of some Weather Underground members, how did some of these folks wind up holding prestigious jobs at top U.S. universities? I asked Ayers about it.
Ultimately, you wound up in Chicago. You got a job teaching with the University of Illinois. Do you see any irony in accepting a government paycheck in winding up where
Absolutely
you
not. What's the irony? Explain
you
it to me.
Spent a life opposing the government regime, wanting to throw down the government, as you put it. Your wife miraculously got a job teaching at Northwestern University Law School very successfully.
Absolutely.
Which is amazing.
They must be
offering classes in what you can learn from your future clients. But are you surprised that you got those job offers, you and she?
Not really. I mean,
she was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list.
I know. So was Angela Davis. A lot of great people have been on that list.
Sure they have. Sorry. This is Joe Connor who you're seeing here. We have to laugh, although we weren't laughing along. Joe's father, seriously, was murdered in a terrorist attack by the FALN. Now, that's a group that wanted to bring about Puerto Rican independence through violent means. He knows a lot about the Weather Underground. Also with us, Andrew McCarthy. He's a former federal prosecutor who helped work to keep one of the Weather Underground members behind bars. Wait till you hear what happened to her. And he's a National Review contributing editor. Good of both of you to be here. There's a lot of great people on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. That's a fantastic list.
Yeah, it's people you want to hang out with.
Yeah, so, you know, let me start with you on this, Andy, because Bill Ayers, I think it was interesting as you watched the Dinesh D'Souza debate where you listen to him. He's intellectual. He's a compelling figure. He makes points. You may disagree with him. You may agree with him. But he seems kind of reasonable on some points. Then you saw the full interview that I did with him, and I think we saw a different man.
Yeah, well, I think the thing with Ayers is he does what every lying criminal does, which is he knows what the known facts are. He knows what you're in a position to prove and what can be proved in court, and he knits his story around it. So it turns out that Ayers had smart bombs before the Pentagon did. He's got the bombs that like rattle the glass but don't kill the people, mm-hmm. and we never did anything violent. In the meantime, if you go back and look at his own words, which you went through with him.
I've never seen anybody do that with him before.
Right?
Show him the evidence in his face and say, right. You did do it, you admitted to it, but like so many people who don't tell the truth, he has forgotten
the
stories.
But he's gotten away with it for 40 years. Why shouldn't you look?
And that's where we pick up today.
Right.
He not only has he gotten away with it, and the others, But they have been embraced by the academic community, Joe. I mean, you look at that full screen. Look at there. Ayers University of Chicago. Bernadine Dorn is at Northwestern Law School. My head is going to explode. Kathy Boudin, who served 20 years for murdering two cops and a security guard, is at Columbia University. And this other one at New York City High Schools.
I have a son who's going to be graduating high school next year, and we're looking at colleges. I would want to know as a parent where my kid is going. If you bought food, you find out what the ingredients are. If I'm going to pay $60,000, I want to find out that we have terrorists teaching our kids.
And City College wanted to honor the folks who killed your father in a terrorist attack here in New York.
They had a community center named for Guillermo Morales and Asante Shakur, who was, Morales is the bomb maker for the FAL, and Shakur was Joanne Chazimard, who killed Warner Forster on the New Jersey Turnpike. And they had a community center honoring them, a place where my father went to college. So this is what we're dealing with the left in this country. When they realized, Megan, that they couldn't beat us by bombing us, by attacking, they turned to academia, they turned to the media, they turned to law, and they got to in government. And now we've seen the result of that. Mm-hmm. It's been generational, it's been slow growth, but it's happened. That's what we have now.
They're everywhere. I mean, when you look at where they wound up, they're at these prestigious universities, they are hobnobbing with future presidents. Right. It's insane when you think about the extent of their influence today, Andy.
Except, Megan, that the campus is where it all began. This is where the revolution grew up. This is where it started. This is where it grew out from. On the campus, they are iconic figures because the formative experience of the people who now run the institutions of opinion, very much including the campus, are the Vietnam War, the anti-war protest, the Watergate scandal, the COINTELPRO, the domestic spying scandals and the like. Mm-hmm. They came to attach nobility to a war against the United States. And if you go back and read their own words, it was very much a war against the United States during which they wanted to mass murder Americans, not just rattle a bunch of glass.
Why? But, you know, people used to talk about Ayers and Obama, President Obama. Like, you need to pay attention to this. Why? Why is it relevant if they were only friendly, if he did an event in the living room? Why?
Yeah. Would you associate with a known terrorist? We're talking about our president. We're not talking about a local mayor. We're not talking about a friend. We're talking about the president of the United States associating himself with a known terrorist. And not only him. There's others in Chicago. There's Jose Lopez, Oscar Lopez's brother. We see that our president has been dealing with terrorists. How could we have fallen so low? I mean, it just boggles the mind.
He didn't just know him. He endorsed his book. Ayers wrote a book called A Kind and Just Parent. Obama said it was a searing and timely account.
Talk about not Barack Obama, but Eric Holder, because he has an interesting role in all of this as well. Tell us.
Well, sure. Holder was the deputy attorney general during the Clinton administration who engineered the FALN pardons that Joe's talking about.
Pardoning the group that killed your father.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
And by the way, the audience should know, they weren't sitting in jail asking for a pardon.
No, they didn't request it.
The Clinton administration reached out to them through Eric Holder, who was helping them,
and said,
hey, how'd you like to get out of jail? And they said, oh, that would be great.
Well, they didn't. At first, they didn't. They denied it for 30 days. And one of them, Oscar Lopez, who I mentioned before, denied it altogether. So you had an attorney general, a future attorney general, and a president pushing the release of terrorists who didn't want it.
And what did he do with respect to the Weather Underground, Eric?
Well, the last day of Clinton's term in office, he walked out the door to Weather Underground terrorists. Everybody remembers the Mark Rich pardon. Right. What they don't remember are Susan Rosenberg and Linda Evans.
What happened to Susan Rosenberg? What's she doing now?
Well, she ended up for a while teaching at, I think it was John Jay College.
Teaching at another college.
Right. Oh, two colleges. I think she then went to Hamilton for a while.
My mind is going to explode. Yeah. It's going to explode.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how we're supposed to screen for this when we send our kids to college.
Well, because
ask them whether they have a criminal history? Could you ask them whether they ever bombed anything? Could you make sure your professor didn't do that before you start listening to him?
It's a PhD in social justice. That's basically when you come out of federal prison after a terrorism conviction, you might as well have been getting an academic degree because that's the way you get treated.
I got to go, but quickly, what did you think of the Ayers exchange? What did you think of the whole thing?
I thought that he was a liar. I think he's a punk. I saw that face that a normal human being would say he obfuscated, he lied. He was just like every other terrorist. He blamed the Vietnam War for things. Justifying his own homicide, at least sociopathology.
He denied
for the Vietnam
homicides.
War. Yeah, but there was an officer killed, and he was a member of that conspiracy that killed the officer. And then when he talked about being anti-war, He wasn't anti-war. He was anti-American winning the Vietnam War. Well, and that's what he was about.
And sounds, you know, as he said explicitly, not proud to be an American
not
to this
proud.
Day. Guys, good to see you.
Thanks, Megan.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Well, when we talked to Ayers this week, we heard one thing over and over. Blame it on Vietnam. This is all about what was happening in Vietnam. He claimed the tactics, the violence, even the terror were nothing in comparison to what was happening in Southeast Asia. But was that the case? Ralph Peters joins us next to fact check that part of the record.
The idea that somehow this is the moral equivalent of 6,000 people a week being killed strikes me as nuts. We were destroying property, and in the course of discussion, some people thought we should go much further.
Your critics say when you make that argument, you sound like Adolf Hitler. Bill Ayers, over and over again, blaming Vietnam. Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters is a Fox News strategic analyst to respond to this. He's also author of the novel Hell or Richmond, which he just received the American Library Association's Boyd Award for Excellence for writing. Ralph, good to see you. And so that was what he said repeatedly. The reason he did what he did and the Weather Underground members did what they did was because we were killing 6,000 people a week in the Vietnam War. True?
No, it simply wasn't true. That's a figure the hard left just pulled out of thin air. In fact, you know, Vietnam was a long and brutal war, and some Americans, a small number, were involved in atrocities. The North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, our enemies, committed vastly more atrocities. The difference is, when Americans committed atrocities, we wound up prosecuting them. They went to jail. That's not to excuse them, but this notion that we just went there and slaughtered innocent civilians right and left, that's the Oliver Stone version of history. But Megan, the bad news is you're going to get a lot more of that version of history because conservatives made a huge mistake in the last 50 years by abandoning the educational system, K through 12 and university through graduate school, to the hard left. And we've taken history teaching out of the schools. We've, you know, civics has been perverted to be anti-American. And the product is a generation of young people who know the Bill Ayers side but not the facts. And by the way, it's about time people just stopped insulting Vietnam veterans. They were not monsters and butchers and baby killers. They were young men serving their country when the likes of Bill Ayers wouldn't.
He has a very different view. I mean, he thinks John McCain is a war criminal, which he said specifically, and then he thinks Bo Bergdahl is a hero, that we should be building monuments to deserters because he feels that they had the courage to stand up for what they believed in.
Megan, since 1775, Lexington and Concord, for 239 years, good men and brave men have given their lives so that Bill Ayers had a right to be a horse's ass. And he is. But what you see here really is his undeniable influence on President Obama. Not just in Obama's denial of American exceptionism, his belief that America is the problem, not the solution, but specifically in the Bergdahl case, where our president, this, you know, acolyte of Bill Ayers, treated Bergdahl and his family better than he treated any American hero, dead or alive, and their families. So this idea that, yes, deserters are somehow heroes, that America's really somehow at fault for Islamist terrorism, that Palestinians are freedom fighters, that the Israelis are oppressors, this is all pure Bill Ayers. And it's just like sitting in the Reverend Wright's church. You don't do it for year after year after year after year and not pick anything up. And oh, by the way, Bill Ayers and Bernadette Turner were not holding fundraisers for Obama because they thought he was a great American.
Well, I mean, that's the question. And I've read a lot of Bill Ayers' discussions about Barack Obama, and in every single one he distances, you know, he wasn't prepared to discuss that in the full extent of that relationship. So people can draw whatever conclusions they want to draw, but I think at least now the record's been set straight on who it was, in whose living room Barack Obama was back in those days, and we have a better feeling for that man. Ralph, I got to go. Thanks so much for being here, sir.
Thank you, Megan.